It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Much of Wisconsin is seeing improved air quality as wildfires continue to blaze in Minnesota and Canada, polluting air throughout the upper Midwest.
The recent fires have scorched roughly 70,000 acres in and around the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. The region in northeastern Minnesota attracts thousands of Wisconsinites who flock there to paddle, camp, and enjoy nature.
Much of Wisconsin was blanketed in wildfire smoke late last week and over the weekend, leading the Department of Natural Resources to issue an air quality alert until yesterday evening.
Smoke pollution is set to improve today, but more than 900 wildfires continue to burn across Canada, and dozens are burning in Minnesota.
For the latest, we're joined by Dan Crocker, reporter for Minnesota Public Radio based in Duluth, who's been covering the fires in Minnesota. We're reaching him in Ely, Minnesota. Dan, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. You've reported more than a dozen wildfires are burning in the Superior National Forest and the Boundary Waters is closed. Parts of the Superior National Forest are closed. What is the latest on the blazes?
Yeah, it's they're still burning strong here. 70,000 acres, as you mentioned, have burned already. For context, that's about the size of the entire cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Wow. There are about 800 firefighters from around the country here on the ground. So it's an all hands on deck situation. I was here last week and the fires early last week, it was 100 degrees here. Winds were raging and the fires ran miles in one day. And that's what sent up the huge plumes of smoke that went into Wisconsin and elsewhere. And the situation has improved. The weather's moderated. It's cool and wet here today. The air quality is much better. But firefighters are stressing that this is going to be a long fight. We still have a lot of weeks of hot weather ahead of us. And they're saying these fires are going to be burning for weeks, if not months.
Tens of thousands of acres, as you mentioned, have burned in the Boundary Waters region in Minnesota. Can you talk more about what those conditions were that ignited the fires in the Boundary Waters?
Yeah, so there was a storm that passed through in early July that had literally thousands of lightning strikes around the forest. And the conditions were just, to be honest, kind of surreal. I mean, 100-degree temperatures up here are unheard of. It was incredibly dry, incredibly hot for this type of year. And those lightning strikes started a lot of small fires, and they were largely under control until that weather picked up last week that I mentioned, where these incredibly strong winds, incredibly hot temperatures, and just sent these fires raging. I mean, fires are a natural part of the ecosystem up here, but we tend to get them early in the spring before spring greenup, or late in the fall, late in the summer, early fall, when things get really dry. It's very unusual to have fires of this magnitude during this time of year.
So hundreds of firefighters, about 800 you mentioned, battling these blazes and putting up perimeters. I imagine they have to make some hard choices, some strategic choices. What are they focused on saving?
Yeah, they've been focused. I mean, obviously, firefighter safety, safety of folks around here is a priority, but they're really focusing on areas where the fire could run into places where there are cabins and homes and resorts. So they've been working hard to protect structures out in front of the fires where the fires could get to. So if they did make it to those structures, there would still be a chance of saving them. That's been a real priority for them right now. There's one wildfire called the Thumb Fire burning up in the northern part of the Boundary Waters Wilderness near the border. They haven't really been able to do much with that because it's burning in a remote area. They've been focusing more where the fires could reach into some of those populated areas.
And we're reaching you in Ely. What impacts have you seen on people, on businesses in the area? I mean, this is a hugely outdoors community.
That's right. And it's going to be a big economic toll. The Boundary Waters Canoe Area has been completely closed now since early last week. It's going to be closed through at least Friday, likely much longer. And that affects a lot of seasonal business up here. There are lots of canoe outfitters who they make their hay during these few months of the summer when 150,000 folks from around the country come to visit the Boundary Waters. There's a big blueberry festival here this weekend, big arts festival that attracts tens of thousands of people. That's been canceled. So it's going to be a big economic toll, not only now, but likely for the rest of the summer.
What about the canoeists? Because there was a big evacuation of these paddlers. Have they been safely evacuated?
Yeah, I asked that of the Forest Service yesterday. They'll never know 100% sure because they don't keep tabs on everybody individually, but thousands of canoeists did evacuate in front of the fires. I talked to some folks It was a pretty close call for some people. There were some pretty dramatic escapes where folks were literally paddling through fire. But as far as the Forest Service knows, everyone's been accounted for. All the outfitters have said that all of their clients have been accounted for. So that's good news.
Dan, before we let you go, as you said, there is more fire season ahead. We've learned in recent days it could take until snowfall for these wildfires to fully extinguish. Are these blazes here to stay until the weather turns?
Most likely, yes. That doesn't mean they couldn't get contained. Like, they could get containment lines around these fires at some point, and they will. But the fire is burning so deep in the ground, like all that organic duff layer of the forest, 2 to 3 feet into the soil, the fire is burning down in there. So that's going to take a long time for that to go out. Even when firefighters get containment lines around, it's going to likely take lots of heavy rain, if not snow, to actually extinguish all these wildfires.
Dan, thank you for your reporting. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Dan Crocker is a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio based in Duluth, covering wildfires in the Boundary Waters and Superior National Forest. We reached him in Ely. Now for a look at the impact of smoke from these fires, we zoom in on southeastern Wisconsin. Liz Adams is acting director of the Racine County Office of Emergency Management. Liz, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So yesterday, air quality in Racine County was in the unhealthy range. I understand the county has dealt with some of the worst air quality in the state throughout this week of smoke pollution. How bad has the smoke been this last week?
It's been pretty bad, especially for, you know, those who have respiratory conditions or are, you know, otherwise more susceptible to the effects of the smoke. But really for anyone, it's at unhealthy levels. So we've had, you know, quite a few events get postponed or canceled just to keep people safe.
How have you dealt with the smoke from an emergency management standpoint?
From an EN standpoint, there's not really too much that we can do. It's not like we can cart out giant fans and blow the smoke away. But we have been providing N95 masks to our first responders and other county employees who spend a lot of their workday outside. We've also just been coordinating with our other partners to make sure that people have resources like that should they need them.
Are you going through masks? What has that supply been like?
Right now, we have a good supply. Still, we have quite a few left over from COVID, so we've been able to use up those. If the smoke were to continue much longer, we probably would have to look at, you know, getting more of those resources in place, looking at ordering some more.
Liz, turning to another weather hazard impacting Racine, in April, the storms that caused an estimated $20 million in damage across Racine, Bayfield, Manitowoc, and Marathon counties. We learned last week Racine County was denied the FEMA assistance funds to address these damages. Racine County, one of four counties, denied that FEMA for damages from storms in April. How much money was denied? What can you tell us here?
Yeah, so we were unfortunately denied because after FEMA came and did their assessment of our damages, they determined that we hadn't met our eligibility threshold that's federally set. So for us in Racine County, our threshold is about $980,000. And they determined that we had actually only gotten about $870,000 worth of damages.
That is really close.
Yes, it is.
What impact will this denial have on county finances and on your residents?
It could definitely be very stressful for county finances as well as municipality finances. As far as county-owned assets go, most of our damages came from damaged roads and bridges, culverts, things like that. I don't have the exact breakdown of numbers in front of me at the moment, but our total damages for county roads comes out to about a third to a quarter of the annual DPW budget. So that alone is, you know, a significant burden on the county.
Has the county gone ahead and made those infrastructure repairs? What is the status of repairs?
For most of the smaller projects, most of them have been completed at this point. I believe the largest project, which was a failed culvert, is still underway. They don't have the resources to fix it in the county, so they'll have to contract out. And so they're still in the process of finding the contractor, going through bids, all of that.
So the FEMA official said damage to public infrastructure in Racine and other Wisconsin counties lacks the severity and magnitude to warrant federal assistance. What do you make of that assessment?
Yes, that's what their assessment says. For us here in Racine, because we were so close to meeting our threshold, we are going to be appealing, which basically means that we'll be submitting additional documentation to show that we did meet the severity to warrant assistance. So we'll be going through that process the next couple of weeks.
How long does the appeals process take?
Usually a few weeks. It's a very quick turnaround from the moment you hear that you've been denied assistance. You have 30 days to file an appeal. So our appeal would be due no later than August 7th.
What other options do municipalities in Racine County have to pay for these damages without this FEMA assistance?
Unfortunately, there's not too many other options. There are some other grant programs that could possibly be an option. We could look into, maybe restructuring some budgets. That would be on the municipality level, of course. I don't really have too much say over that. But it is really hard when you are impacted by a disaster like what happened in April and you don't know where the money is going to come from.
Liz, thank you for this update. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Liz Adams is acting director of the Racine County Office of Emergency Management. Earlier, we heard from Dan Crocker, a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio based in Duluth, who's been covering the Boundary Waters wildfires as we've watched those plumes of smoke move through Wisconsin and the impact.
Coming up, as the Trump administration turns away from solar and wind energy, we check in on the future of clean energy here in Wisconsin.
If we really want to make the affordable decision for ratepayers, it's more economical to take those coal plants and natural gas plants offline, replace it with new clean energy, and use that to power the data centers, power your EVs.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kelda Royce is no stranger to seeking higher office. After previous failed bids for Congress and governor, the state senator is running for governor in 2026.
As Sarah Lear reports, this time around, the detail-oriented Democrat is leaning on her experience ahead of a jam-packed primary election.
When you ask Kelda Royce's allies to describe her, there's a common refrain. Here's former Dane County Supervisor Carousel Baird.
She wants to break down every tiny piece, but I think that that's what sets her apart, the level of intentional attention to detail.
Here's the State Assembly's former Democratic Minority Leader, Gordon Hintz.
I respect her work ethic and her digging in on policy details.
And here's Royce herself.
I do have very, very detailed plans for not just what my vision is, which is raising wages, lowering costs, fully funding public schools, and protecting our rights and freedoms from this dangerous Trump regime.
In this primary with lots of choices, Royce wants voters to know she's someone with experience in government. Endorsed by the state's largest teachers union, she says she'd push to spend Wisconsin's budget surplus on public education. She's called for ending Wisconsin's private school voucher program. And at a recent union town hall, she said Wisconsin should open its state employee health care plan to any resident who opts to pay into it.
The very same coverage that I get as a state senator, which is great health care coverage, and let anybody buy in.
A former director of NARAL Pro-Choice Wisconsin, Royce has advocated for repealing statewide restrictions on abortion. She served 6 years in the state Senate, including an unsuccessful bid to become Senate Minority Leader. Before that, she founded a real estate technology company after spending 4 years in the state assembly. When she remembers that first assembly campaign, Royce rattles off some details.
I knocked on 20,252 doors as an underdog candidate and ended up winning.
Royce was an underdog again when she ran for governor in 2018, placing third in a crowded primary. She was a favorite of some in the Democratic base that year. And her campaign got national media attention because of an ad featuring her newborn daughter. Barry Burden is a political scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
She sort of lit fire when one of her ads involved her breastfeeding her child on camera, and that got attention. It was circulated for free.
2026 has been a different story. With seven Democrats running to start, Royce struggled to stand out. Other contenders include Madison State Representative Francesca Hong, a Democratic socialist who has energized the party's left wing, and former Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, who came close to winning a seat for U.S. Senate 4 years ago. Burden sees Royce as on the progressive end of the spectrum, but
she is not the only Madison candidate in the race. She's not the only state legislator in the race. She's not the only female candidate in the race. And she's not the most progressive candidate.
The race has been shaken up recently. A few candidates dropped out, and one candidate, Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley, rejoined the race with Governor Tony Evers' endorsement. Royce has stuck with it. She raised around $900,000 and announced TV ad buys, including one where urgent music plays as an ambulance barrels down in the background.
Healthcare should be a right, but the system is broken. Republicans like Trump broke it so that insurance companies could profit more. It's almost like they're trying to kill us.
Royce concedes she has fallen short in past runs for higher office, but she says every race is different.
Our political culture too often rewards risk aversion and complacency, and instead, we should be encouraging people to run for office and to take risks.
Royce maintains she has the experience and the attention to detail needed to win this summer's primary and to win in November. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR will continue our series on the governor's race Thursday with a profile of Democrat Joel Brennan. This is WPR News.
Clean energy industries have faced some conflicting signals in recent years. When President Trump returned to office, he pushed to end federal subsidies for things like solar panels, electric cars, heat pumps, and more efficient appliances, and directed the federal government to pay energy companies to cancel wind energy projects.
But with energy costs soaring, in part because of the war in Iran, green infrastructure is still getting a lot of interest and development. How are these conflicting pressures affecting Wisconsin businesses and consumers?
In a moment, we'll hear from one of Wisconsin's larger solar installers. But first, for an overview, we turn to Emma Hines, principal at Advanced Energy United, where she works with policymakers, businesses, and advocates to promote clean energy in Wisconsin. Emma, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
There is a lot of flux and motion when it comes to energy these days. A big change, of course, from the White House in attitudes toward clean energy, demand from data centers, Iran war, so many things going on. Big picture, how would you characterize Wisconsin in its transition to clean energy and technology?
It's certainly a tumultuous time in the industry, but not all hope is lost. I think we're still in a really great space in Wisconsin on the clean energy transition, mostly because the economics have really changed over the last decade of how we're using clean energy. Right now, you know, we're seeing so much load growth from home electrification, from data centers, from EVs, all kinds of different areas. But renewable energy is really ready to meet that moment. Right now, renewable energy is the fastest form of energy to get on the grid, and it's also the cheapest per unit of energy that you're using. So we have the tools to be able to meet this moment, which is really exciting.
When it comes to things like solar and wind power, how does Wisconsin compare to neighboring states?
So we're not doing as well as a lot of other states in the Midwest. And I think, you know, policy is really important for that. A lot of states like Illinois or Michigan or Minnesota have had really strong climate and clean energy packages in the last couple of years from the state government that's really directed utilities to put more clean energy on the grid. We haven't had that in the same way in Wisconsin. And so I think, you know, we're lagging behind a little bit because we haven't had such clear instructions, essentially, from the state government. But the economics are really catching up. And so when Wisconsin is looking to put so much energy on the grid in the next 10 years, utilities are really looking at renewable energy, utility scale wind and solar to meet that moment.
We're seeing, of course, demand from data centers and other increasing electrical demand. And the temptation, I think, there is has been to say, hey, we need to keep a coal power plant open longer, which Wisconsin will do with a White House grant. We need new natural gas plants to meet that baseline capacity need. How do you make the case to turn to renewables instead of those more traditional coal power and natural gas plants?
If we really want to make the affordable decision for ratepayers, it's more economical to take those coal plants and natural gas plants offline, replace it with new clean energy, and use that to power the data centers, power your EVs and things like that. The difference is so drastic in terms of cost comparison that it doesn't always make sense, you know, why it would seem cheaper to keep something online, but the economics of renewables are really just in our favor. And part of that has to do with the fact that we don't pay for fuel. The sun pretty much always shines and the wind is constantly blowing here in the Midwest. So you're not as dependent on, you know, foreign conflicts in the Middle East or different, you know, federal trade policies or things like that for how expensive your power bill is going to be.
Another big hope, I think, from the clean energy world would be electrification of our automobile fleet so that electricity generated by renewable sources could replace gasoline and diesel. Wisconsin, I understand, has been a little slow when it comes to adopting electric vehicles. What do you see happening here, especially as some federal subsidies have gone away?
Yeah, absolutely. Wisconsin has been on the slower side. And I think, you know, it's sort of a chicken and egg problem for vehicle electrification because people are hesitant to invest in such a, you know, different kind of car if they don't see charging infrastructure around them. Range anxiety is a huge issue of people saying, well, you know, I go up to Wausau to visit my in-laws 3 times a year. So I don't know. I haven't seen charging along my route. It's probably not a good fit for me. But then also from the charging developer side, they maybe might be more hesitant to invest in charging stations because there are less EVs in the state than, say, Illinois or Minnesota or something. So the state has done a really good job with what's called the NEVI program. It's the National EV Infrastructure Program that is designed to create kind of a statewide network of fast charging along our major highway corridors. So that is designed to really bring more visible, reliable charging stations so people know they can get across the state and go to a Packer game or something and not have to worry about their range running out.
Getting back to that home solar you mentioned a few moments ago, there have been concerns that with the end of federal subsidies for home solar, that's going to take away some of the infrastructure, right? The companies that have been installing them might not stick around. What are you seeing when it comes to capacity in Wisconsin to build and install solar panels?
Yeah, I definitely would say the solar industry, specifically the residential solar industry, is not going away. It probably is consolidating a fair amount because you have to think about, you know, these tax credits were up to 30% of project costs. And so the businesses that aren't able to essentially cut their costs by 30% to stay afloat, that's not an economical decision for them anymore. So we're certainly going to see the industry consolidate, but it also, it doesn't change the demand for these kinds of projects. Folks that maybe were interested in rooftop solar before, that doesn't go away just because the tax credit goes away. It changes the economics and it maybe changes the timeline of their decision and when they'll choose to make that investment and who's able to make that investment. It requires 30% more cash, but folks are still really looking for ways to reduce their energy bill, you know, reduce the amount of natural gas they're using or something like that. It's still a really important tool for people to kind of reduce their carbon input from the utility bill.
Emma, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Emma Hines is a principal at Advanced Energy United, where she works with policymakers, businesses, and advocates to promote clean energy in Wisconsin. Now we'll meet a company that's a leader in the green sector here in the state. J.D. Smith is Director of Marketing and Public Relations at Arch Solar. The Milwaukee-based company installs solar energy and battery power for utilities, companies, and residents around the country.
JD, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
We just heard that this is a rough time for some solar installers with some consolidation expected in the industry. What are you seeing there at Arch Solar?
So I would say that that's accurate. It really depends on a lot of dynamics for that installer. Basically, the main two are size and what they build. If you're a small solar company that primarily services homeowners, you're definitely in for a rockier period. Arch is really fortunate because we are one of the largest in Wisconsin, and we're also one of the oldest. We've been around since 2003. And a side effect of that is that we do every size of solar, which that is what you kind of need to do to navigate these ups and downs of the coaster. And right now we're in a major downward trend for certain parts of the industry.
Yeah, on that residential, right, that home solar, how big an impact were the rebates going on, the incentives from the federal government under the Biden administration, and then those going away under the second Trump administration?
Well, the biggest thing about the incentives was that they were locked in for 10 years. So that kind of gave homeowners, you know, previous to the Biden administration, the investment tax credit for residential solar would change every year. It would go from 24% to 22% to 20% and then back up to 26%, which meant that every year you were kind of gambling. What the IRA did was it locked it in for 10 years, and that kind of gave homeowners, okay, you can plan for it. So we saw that it actually slowed down sales because there wasn't a cliff coming of we got to get this in while the tax credit's still there. It removed that sense of urgency, which for me is a really good thing because it means that people are taking their time making the decisions, which means happier customers. When it went away, we saw a lot of people rushing to get in right before the tax credit went, which at the end of the day, if you're going to make a upfront cash purchase that's can be as much as a new car with solar, you don't want to be rushed in that decision. So that, to me, was one of the biggest negatives of how fast that got taken away in the second Trump administration.
Now, you mentioned Arch Solar been around for over 20 years now. What have been some of the biggest changes you've seen in this line of work?
When I started working on the phone 6 years ago, we would get, you know, one in four customers would ask about batteries. And then as soon as you tell them, hey, to go off the grid, you're really going to be paying, you know, over 50 grand to even think about it. Then they'd say, no, you know, I'm not interested in it, and I was only going to do this if I could go off grid. Whereas now, at least half of our customers are moving forward with batteries, and it's not about going entirely off the grid. It's about having backup in the case of an outage and just reducing your reliance on the grid. That's an entirely different dynamic where people are not taking the power grid for granted anymore. And they're doing, even if they can't go 100% cut the grid, they can protect themselves as much as possible. And that's happened in the last 2 years, really.
Now, in the holy grail for clean energy, especially renewables like wind and solar, where you don't have that perpetual source, is like the most efficient and affordable battery. Have you seen that battery technology changing so that for that individual consumer, it's more of a realistic option?
Absolutely. And the reality of it is that the Tesla Powerwall was kind of the breakthrough in terms of not technology, but in terms of marketing and accessibility. The name brand of Tesla, particularly back in 2020 to 2022, was so powerful that people were like, hey, I've heard Tesla has a battery. We introduced them to a bunch of options, including Generac even has a battery made here in Wisconsin. You know, they purchased a old company and fixed it up and have a great product. But that mind share of people being aware, because I think back in 2022, if you asked the average person, did you know you could have your home run off a battery powered by the sun? They'd say no way. Whereas now, if you say that thing, people are like, yeah, it sounds realistic. That's a huge change, and we're seeing, but the real progress in batteries that we're seeing is on the utility scale.
And you mentioned you do a lot of different size projects. Are you doing those utility scale? You know, you see not just a collector on a rooftop, but a whole bunch of collectors altogether.
Correct. Right now, that's where the solar industry is still growing like you wouldn't believe, because just even without the tax credits, solar economics just makes sense. It's also the only form of power plant you can build really fast under a year in almost every case. And you can also build it in a variety of locations. That's not the same for a natural gas plant or a coal plant. So solar farms that put power directly onto the grid are growing across the country in some states more than others. And now what we're seeing in Wisconsin right now, but especially in Illinois and Minnesota, is batteries. Huge scale batteries that, you know, can store over a megawatt of power are starting to become connected to the grid. That's going to be the next 5 years of work.
Now, we've talked a little bit about residential, right? Rooftop solar, utility scale. I'm curious about the sort of middle things. Like I'll see at the airport, say, well, we've got land. We can't build anything here because flight path. We could put panels there. And I've seen them do that. Farm fields in some cases where they'll have borders of solar panels. Are you seeing a lot of people, you know, finding those funky spaces where you can get more than just that a couple panels on a roof, less than utility scale?
So those are my personal favorite projects because they're kind of the sweet spot where businesses, communities, nonprofits, and organizations can come together. And in some cases, that has the greatest wins. I think one of our recent projects is the Pettit National Ice Center. Solar there isn't going to take their whole bill. They use far too much energy, but the payback and economics of it are fantastic. So that's something that I drive by living in Milwaukee almost every day and get to see. And now that's powered by the sun. And then you have nonprofits. I used to work in the nonprofit sector. You need every penny to go somewhere and go as stretch as far as you can. For them, solar makes a lot of sense when you have high energy. So like Hunger Task Force is a great partner of ours that has done solar. And for them, it makes sense. What I would say in the new era of post-tax credits, I always encourage businesses, make sure you know what your energy loads are. It's almost best if the accountants are running it because solar is electricity, which means you can measure it. We really like working with either new builds who know exactly how much energy is going to be on there or large energy consumers like the Pettit who monitor their energy usage very carefully.
JD, thanks so much for sharing your work with us.
Anytime, Rob. Thank you for having me.
JD Smith is Director of Marketing and Public Relations at Arch Solar, a Milwaukee-based company that installs solar energy and battery storage. Earlier, we heard from Emma Hines, a principal at Advanced Energy United. We've been talking about renewable energy here in Wisconsin.
Coming up, a new forest bathing trail near Eagle River will help people disconnect from their screens and reconnect with the natural world.
It's not really about hiking or necessarily getting somewhere. It's about just taking your time and engaging all your senses and being fully present with the natural world.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This summer, Wisconsin will open its first certified forest bathing trail.
Located just south of Eagle River, the quarter-mile Tara Lila Forest Bathing Trail will offer self-guided mindfulness activities. There are 51 trails of its kind around the globe.
These trails are designed to create a deeper connection with nature through slow, mindful movements. To become certified, sites have to go through a complex process and meet a list of 36 different criteria.
Holly Jo Walters is Program Director for the Association of Nature and Forest Therapy's Certified Forest Therapy Trails Program. And Cindy Conlon is a Certified Forest Therapy Guide and Trail Consultant in Eagle River. Cindy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
And Holly Jo, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Before we visit this trail in Eagle River, Holly Jo, introduce us, please, to this concept of forest bathing.
A lot of folks kind of laugh or chuckle when they first hear the term forest bathing because I think they're kind of imagining a bathtub in the woods, but it's nothing like that. It's a practice that began in Japan in the 80s. The government was really concerned about just stress and burnout and the health impacts of people spending less time in nature. And so as part of a broader public health initiative, they encouraged people to slow down and spend, you know, intentional time in the forest. And so it's a little bit different. It's not, you know, it's not really about hiking or necessarily getting somewhere. It's about just taking your time and engaging all your senses and being fully present with the natural world. So,
and Holly Jo, what do we know about the health benefits of getting ourselves out in nature like this?
I know I'm feeling a lot of stress just in the amount of time I spend in front of our screens these days. I'm pretty sure my heart rate's elevated, all those things. And what we know is just spending 20 minutes outside in nature has really big impacts actually on our bodies. So, I mean, we see lower cortisol levels, lower heart rates, and there's just so many, really diseases and illnesses that are related to stress. So just taking a little bit of time, 20 minutes outside, is going to make a huge difference. And beyond that, you know, the trees gift us. We evolved with the trees, and they actually emit this amazing compound called a phytoncide. These have been studied for years now, but, you know, basically when a tree is getting attacked by a fungi or something that, you know, might impact the health of the tree, they release phytoncides to protect themselves. And we actually, our bodies actually respond to those phytoncides. So when we walk in the trees, we're actually breathing those in. And what happens is we see a big increase in a cell called the NK killer cell. It's a natural killer cell. And these cells like float throughout our bodies and like find free radicals and actually specifically target cancer cells. So just spending 3 hours out in the forest can have an impact for days. So there's just a lot of science behind it. But in addition to that, it feels good. I think anybody that spends a lot of time in nature and finds a solace out there understands what that feeling is. But there's definitely a lot of science behind it as well.
And Cindy, introduce us to this path in Eagle River, the trail, a Tara Leela Trail. I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you. Richard and Amy Jo Aylward in 2007 wanted to create a place that people could enjoy nature silently. They actually, on their website, when talked about their mission, said the most satisfactory way to truly and deeply enjoy nature is to go quietly. So I found their land conservancy. It's about 10 minutes from downtown Eagle River. It's super accessible. And I started going there myself. Absolutely loved it. And then I became certified as a forest therapy guide through ANFT, Holly Jo's organization, and started leading forest bathing sessions there for people in Eagle River. So I was really attached to this property. And last January, after I read more about the certification process that Holly Jo is director of for ANFT, I emailed, just called the land manager and said, hey, I already use your trail. How about we become a certified forest bathing trail? And he emailed right back and said, I love everything about this idea. How do we do it? So I had to reach out to Holly Jo because I'm like, I actually don't know how you do it, but let's do it. And so we did.
We'll get into that certification in a minute, but Cindy is staying with you. Now, sometimes when I'm out walking in the woods in nature, I don't know, I'm going full speed, right? I'm covering a lot of ground, and that's fine. There's a healthiness to that, I think. What are you doing, though, when you're guiding people through forest bathing on a trail?
Well, you're providing, first of all, a curated space, which is partially what the certification is about. So this space is one that's going to naturally be quiet. It's going to meet many criteria, including having ideally dappled light. It's going to be accessible. It's not going to have any hazards. We don't have on my trail, I've checked, there's no poison ivy or logs. It's maintained so that when you're there, you're going to be safe. So that I think the first thing about being in this kind of experience is if you're going to calm your central nervous system, you have to feel comfortable, welcome, and safe. So we find a space that offers people that. And then secondly, I lead them through a series of invitations that help them connect with their senses. Again, we have an intention usually to get to the next task. And as you said, we're on to the next thing. When they're forest bathing, ideally, I as the guide can help them put their phone away, turn their watch into their pocket, and let go of time and really connect with all the senses to relate to the forest in a very deep and profound way.
Holly Jo, Cindy was just giving a couple of the basics there of what can make a trail, an appropriate place, a certifiable place for forest bathing. What does it take to find these trails and make sure, yeah, this is the right environment for this?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, the process, I think, seems rigorous because we look at a lot of different things. But the reality is every natural space is certifiable. So we're not coming in and saying yes or no. The idea is to come in and actually curate the experience based on the landscape and the ecosystem that's there. So, you know, we have 51 trails across the world, and no two trails are alike. So every single trail is going to offer different elements. There's going to be a different type of sensory engagement that each trail is going to offer. And so, yeah, while we look at a number of factors around safety and, you know, safety on the trail, we look at the ecosystem health, we take in design considerations, and even how the space is managed. I often think these trails are also part of initiatives to really bring into focus the mission and values of the organizations that are engaging with us in this way. So we look at all of those things, but we're actually working with what's already existing in their landscape. And then how can we actually invite people into deeper relationship with it? So, you know, we might be creating additional spots for people to pause and just sit and actually take in, you know, whether it's visually or, you know, audibly, or even the smell or taste of the landscape. These things really have the ability to connect people in a way that just simply walking through without really that intention. I don't even want to say mindful, because the idea is to really drop out of our minds, right, and into our bodies and senses, so we
mindlessness.
Can
mindlessness. I can
yes.
get into that.
No kidding, right? I think we all need a little bit more of that these days. But yeah, so. So it really is, you know, about each and every landscape and taking the time to be with each one and understand, you know, not just what we're feeling and seeing and experiencing, but what is the story of this landscape, you know, including the cultures and peoples maybe that came before it. And how are we, you know, how are we helping to connect people to this space?
We're talking about a new forest bathing trail in Wisconsin in Vilas County. Holly Jill Walters is with us from the Association of Nature and Forest Therapy, and Cindy Conlon, certified forest therapy guide and trail consultant in Eagle River. Cindy, just thinking about this, I got to say, I'm kind of chilling out a little bit. You get to observe people, right, on experiences like this. What do you see of the before, during, and after on how people's, I don't know, posture and bearing changes as they experience this?
Oh, it's always a transformation. It's great that you asked that question. It's my favorite part is watching this happen. So people come and they're talking and they're, you know, sometimes they're, you know, kind of walking really fast and they're, you know, talking about how it took to get there and all of that. And then as we start connecting to their breath and they put away their phone, you know, and there's research, by the way, that says that even having your phone out, if it's off, draws some of your attention, which is really scary. So I really encourage them to put it out of sight and even leave it in their car. I'll have a phone if there's an emergency. But I see them kind of just, they almost sigh. You can just see this physical letting go. And then as they get into the experience and they start doing things like, if they're comfortable, closing their eyes and starting noticing what they hear, their other senses become amplified. And we take about 70% of data in through our eyes. So when the eyes are allowed to go offline and we connect with these other senses where we have great ways of knowing, and they start really being present and their breathing slows down, they start walking slowly. And then at the end, when you ask them, what are they noticing? They notice themselves things about the forest that they've never seen. Even when we walk by it, we do a point-to-point at Taralila. So when they come back, they're seeing a part they've already walked. But it is so common for them to say, I know I just saw this 30 minutes ago, but I didn't notice that tree right there in the middle of this area that's by itself. They absolutely see things in a completely new way. And they often say that they've never, well, I had one, we were laying on the ground looking at clouds. And I had a young man say, he was 20. He said, you know, I don't remember doing this. I know I did it when I was like 8 or 9, just being able to be present and look at what's around me. And he actually had tears in his eyes. It was, that's not an uncommon reaction. People are so, they're restored and they're so grateful to just come back to themselves and know that nature helped them do it.
Holly Joe, we've got this one now in Wisconsin. There's, you mentioned, just over 50 around the world. Do you find that people get hooked on these? They become frequent foresters and want to start visiting more and more of these.
You know, I definitely see that happening. And the reality is people actually want more and more of the same places that they're going to. Mm. So each, you know, one of the ideas about visiting these trails is to continue to visit that trail throughout the seasons. Like, that landscape is constantly changing. It's constantly moving. So in order to really get into relationship with a place, right, we get to know it through all its seasons. People are like that too. So, I think, you know, it is inviting people not only into the idea of, wow, these trails exist, I want to see more of them, and they can see them in different ecosystems, different landscapes. Like I said, no two trails are the same. We have trails that don't even have trees. They have cacti, right? So it's a really great opportunity also as a destination for folks that are traveling and looking for ways to actually make an impact too on the ways that people travel. So really baked into the whole philosophy of this program is about reciprocity, because I mean, what we know is that people tend to care for the things they love. I think Jacques Cousteau actually said that. And it's beautiful, because once people come into relationship with a place, they're going to tend and care for that place in a different way. And I think that's really at the heart of all of this. So we're hoping people, yeah, continue to explore all these trails, but also continue to explore the ones that they've already been to on a continual basis. So, you know, and with that, I mean, we've got amazing guides like, you know, Cindy that are, you know, leading walks at these locations. So people can show up and have a self-guided walk where they're experiencing it on their own. And they have the opportunities to dive even deeper, because most forest therapy walks are going to take anywhere from, you know, an hour to 3 hours. And to just be guided in those spaces where you can just kind of like let go of everything and let your body sink into the place and know that someone's, you know, created a container in which you're held through that in such a beautiful way is really just a rejuvenating reset for our systems.
Yeah, and Cindy, my first thought of this would be it would be kind of a solitary activity, but is there a value in doing this forest bathing with a group of people?
Oh, I they're both great, but I really love the collective shared experience of it. So it's building community and it's getting people doing something, you know, off a screen, out of their house where they're connecting with people that they might not have met. I've actually in Eagle River found this whole community of people that I started through forest bathing, and it's just been amazing. I think that shared experience is really valuable when you're asking people, what are you noticing? And if people want to share, they do. And what I always find is that what someone notices sparks something in me. It's like it brings it back a memory, or it connects me more deeply with that experience. It's just really powerful when it's done in a group.
Thanks for sharing this with us. And thanks, Cindy, for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Holly Jo, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
Holly Jo Walters is the program director for the Association of Nature and Forest Therapy's Certified Forest Therapy Trails Program. And Cindy Conlin is a certified forest therapy guide and trail consultant in Eagle River. A celebration for the grand opening of that forest bathing trail is planned for Sunday from 1 to 3 p.m. at the site.
We just learned about the benefits of forest bathing and how taking time to walk in nature can be so good for our mind and body.
And we want to hear your stories about how getting out in nature, how things like forest walks have created balance for you.
Our colleague, producer Trevor Hook, just returned from Yellowstone National Park with his fiance and says they journeyed through Tioga Pass, winding thousands of feet in elevation through mountains, meadows, and waterfalls.
Trevor goes on to say, though Yosemite Valley was a bit crowded at times, the trails and pass still allowed a few moments to catch our breath and listen to the sound of a light wind through pine trees that only grow at high altitudes.
Thanks so much, Trevor. Share your story about forest bathing. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include fresh back from Yosemite Trevor Hook and Joe Tarr and Mackenzie Crummy.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.